Hi friends, this is Brock Polk, and I want to thank you for downloading this sermon from Heritage Church of Christ in Fort Worth, Texas. Our mission is to lead others to a thriving relationship with Jesus, and if you're ready to take a next step in your faith journey after you listen to this message, you can contact us through our website at www.heritagechurchofchrist.org. God bless you, and I hope you enjoy the following message.
Endings are important. Whether movies or books, careers or lives, the way something comes to a conclusion is really important. This is something I think we all intuitively understand. We've all seen the summer blockbuster movie whose ending is so disappointing, we leave the theater thinking only of the 3 hours of valuable time we've just wasted. My hot take is it's Iron Man 3, okay? Or more tragically, we've seen a coworker ruin a great career by burning bridges as he bitterly leaves a job. LeBron James knows that scoring 51 points in an NBA Finals game matters very little in hindsight when your team is swept out of the championship. And Texas Rangers fans know that being one strike away from winning the World Series is decidedly not the same as actually winning a World Series. But since this isn't a sermon about hell, I'm not going to dwell on that anymore. On a more inspiring note, we've all known people who have faced down terminal diseases with bravery and poise, or seen couples who have loved each other with devotion and care to the very ends of their lives. Endings are important. Now, despite that little reflection on the importance of endings, you're probably quite aware, as Brock just said, that today is actually not the ending of a sermon series. It is, of course, the beginning. And Brock has invited me to introduce the Sermon on the Mount and his upcoming series for the summer on the text. And what I want to do today is to prepare us all to listen and reflect in the coming weeks on the important teachings of Christ that are contained in the Sermon on the Mount. But I'm going to do something a little strange this morning. I'm going to introduce the Sermon on the Mount by ruining the ending. The Sermon on the Mount is often considered the heart of Jesus Christ's teachings. It consists of three short chapters, maybe 3 to 5 pages in a Bible, at the beginning of the Gospel of Matthew, the first book in what we typically call the New Testament. It's inspired billions of people, both Christians and non-Christians. The famous Russian Christian novelist Leo Tolstoy spent his life studying the Sermon on the Mount, and its teachings pervade many of his most important works. The great peacemaker Mahatma Gandhi allegedly read the Sermon on the Mount every morning before beginning his work for the day, and he wasn't a Christian. And the German minister, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, devoted time and secrecy under the Nazi regime to writing a reflection and commentary on the Sermon on the Mount. Thematically, the text is concerned with what it means for human beings to live their life in relationship with God, what Jesus calls entering the kingdom of heaven. And Christ's teachings in the sermon are wide-ranging. He speaks about anxiety, about divorce, prayer, fasting, salvation, forgiveness, and a bunch of other topics. And if you just take a quick glance over the three chapters of the Sermon on the Mount, you'll realize how vast the amount of topics it covers are, and you'll realize why this relatively short text has often been considered the summation of the essence of the Christian life. And all the topics I mentioned are important, and due time can and should be given to understanding each. But before diving into the depths of this vast ocean of Christian teaching, I want to begin elsewhere, namely Christ's conclusion to the sermon. So imagine with me for a second that you're living in the time of Christ. Sometime in the Roman Empire, about 2,000 years ago, you're walking around the countryside when you see a large group of people gathered up on top of a large hill. You wander over. The people are strewn about listening to a man you know as Jesus the Carpenter teach about God and his kingdom. You've clearly missed much of what he has said, But you arrive just in time to hear his closing thoughts. This ending is where we're going to begin today. So if you have a biblical text with you, either as a book or on your phone, turn with me to the Gospel of Matthew. This is it's the very first book at the beginning of our New Testament. And we're going to be today in chapter 7, starting in verse 24. It'll also be on the screen behind me. So Jesus, speaking to the crowd at the end of this long sermon, says this: "Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house. Yet it did not fall because it had its foundation on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell with a great crash." The text then continues. When Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, because he taught as one who had authority and not as their teachers of the law. Two things in particular, I think, stand out in this text. The first is the authority of Jesus. When Jesus concludes his teaching, Matthew says, the crowd is amazed because Jesus teaches as one with authority. And not only does Jesus have authority, but, our text says, it's in contrast to the scribes or teachers of the law, those most educated in the teachings of the Jewish scriptures. The second thing that stands out in this text, I think, is the idea of wisdom. Jesus concludes his entire sermon by telling a parable or short story about wisdom. The story draws a contrast between two people: builders who have decided to construct a house in which to live and conduct their affairs. Builders who have decided to construct their house in which to live and conduct their affairs. The two builders have everything in common, nearly. They have both, of course, built homes, and they have faced heavy rains, flooding rivers, and straight-line winds. Yet the single difference between the two is key. One has wisdom, the other does not. One has chosen to build his house on the rock, the other has chosen to build his house on the sand. They have faced the same issues, yet one's home stands firm while the other's has collapsed. Jesus then draws a striking parallel. The person who hears his words, he says, and puts them into practice is like the builder on the rock, that is to say, wise. To hear and practice Jesus' teachings is to be wise. As modern-day hearers of the Sermon on the Mount, I think we have to wrestle with these two key issues. First, to what extent and in what ways do we take Christ's teachings in the Sermon on the Mount to be authoritative, as Matthew says? And second, we have to consider what the nature is of the wisdom of Christ's teachings. That is, what does it mean to say that they are wise? And so it's these two issues, authority and wisdom, that I'd like to reflect further upon with you today in preparation for the rest of your sermon series. So first, let's consider the authority of Christ. In my day job, I am a student and academic, which means that I spend a lot of my time reading, researching, and writing. And if there's one thing that those of us in the academic world are obsessed with, it's evidence. And what I mean by that is, I am not allowed to say or write just anything I want to. I'm certainly allowed to have opinions, I'm allowed to have my own perspectives, but I have to back up those opinions with evidence. I have to make clear arguments, I have to cite sources, and I have to build on the work of others who have gone before me to prove my own views. And closely related to the issue of providing evidence is the issue of authority. I'm not allowed to cite whoever and whatever I want to prove my point. Because my mom said so is not, unfortunately, considered valid proof in a term paper. I'm sorry about that, Mom. The people and books and arguments I cite have to be authoritative in their field. And this insistence on providing authoritative evidence, I should add, is not just collegiate nitpicking. Because where you get your information from matters. The source of your information matters. You and I are not capable of reconstructing the breadth of human knowledge from scratch on our own. We have to listen to others and trust what they know in order to continue learning. But that also means we have to listen to the right people. The people who have spent their lives learning one task so well that they can speak accurately and clearly about the topic. Think, for example, of the talented auto mechanic you trust to make the right decisions working on your vehicle, or the doctor you go to who's able to discern what illnesses you have because of the lifetime of study that he or she has spent. And it's quite clear, I think, from our text that Matthew wishes us to hear Jesus as an authoritative teacher. He is, to put it another way, a trusted source. But why exactly should we agree? The nature of Jesus' authority is often debated today. For some, Jesus is a sage teacher who offers great practical advice about how to live and love. For others, Jesus is a political culture warrior waging an ideological battle against those who err from the party line. And for others, Jesus is a moralizer, entrusting his hearers with sound ethical principles. And while there may be truths to some of these characterizations of Jesus, I actually think the authority of Jesus comes from somewhere else. You see, it would be easy to listen to the teachings of Christ in the Sermon on the Mount and think that it's merely his message that carries the authority. That were anyone to sit on the same mountain as Jesus and recite his teachings, it would be enough. As long as the content is communicated, the truth has been passed along. But I want to suggest that the authority of Christ's teachings has not only to do with the content, however inspiring it may be, but it has to do with the very nature of the person delivering it. Notice again what Matthew 7:29 says. Jesus taught as one having authority. The authority is not inherent solely to the message, but to the person of Jesus Christ himself. It's not the message, but the person that's authoritative. So then, we have to consider what the nature of Christ's person is. What is it about Jesus that grants him such authority? The answer to this question, I think, can be found in part in one of our other earliest Christian writings. This time it's in a letter written by a man named Paul to a young church in the ancient Roman city of Colossae. And Paul, reflecting on the nature of Jesus Christ, writes the following. It'll be on the screen behind me. The Son, meaning Jesus, he says, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. For God was pleased to have his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. Jesus Christ, Paul says, is no ordinary human being. He is the image of God. He is before all things. He is the one in whom all things were created. And he is the one in whom the fullness of God dwells. Jesus Christ, therefore, cannot be reduced to some run-of-the-mill teacher. He's not merely a trusted source because he has good ideas. He is a trusted source because he is God himself. So when we come to the Sermon on the Mount to sit at Jesus' feet and listen to his instructions, we should never lose sight of the fact that we are sitting at the feet of God incarnate. Jesus Christ, Christians have long held, is true God, the Word made flesh, as another New Testament writer states, the second person of the Trinity who has come to walk among us and show us the ways of God. And so hopefully you can see now why the question of authority is so important in our text. The teachings in the Sermon on the Mount about life with God don't come from somebody who, like you and like me, struggles to draw near to God on a daily basis. They come from the mouth of God himself. The maker of all reality, the one who was and is to come, has bent down to us out of care and compassion and beckoned us into a deeper relationship with him. What better teacher of how to conform our lives to the life of God than God himself? And the divine authority of the Sermon on the Mount is undoubtedly good news for us. The Lord is gracious and desires so fully to include us in his kingdom that he will stoop down to teach us directly about what the good and divine life looks like. But even if we accept the truth of this good news, we're still faced with a pressing question raised by our text. That is, what is the nature of the wisdom that Christ teaches in the Sermon on the Mount? In what ways can Christ's teaching be said to be wise? Returning to Christ's parable in Matthew 7, we're reminded of what Christ says about his teachings. "Whoever hears these words of mine and puts them into practice," he says, "is like a wise man who built his house on the rock." Jesus equates his teaching directly with wisdom. His teachings, he says, are like the firm foundation of a house. If we build our lives upon these teachings, we will remain and stand firm through the difficulties of life. So far, so good. But as you read through and study on the Sermon on the Mount in the coming weeks, I imagine that you might begin to feel a certain amount of tension. Maybe you'll grant me, these teachings truly do come from the mouth of God. They're dispatches from the ultimate meant to lead us into deeper connection with the Almighty. But you'll also undoubtedly notice that what Christ has described as wise, the teaching on which he asks us to establish our lives, do not seem, because the teachings of the Sermon on the Mount are rather uncompromising. Jesus says a number of things that seem impractical, unwise, and maybe even downright shocking to us. "You are blessed," for instance, he says, "if you mourn, suffer, give up power, or are persecuted against." Or, he teaches, "being angry with someone is as bad as murder." Or, he says, "you should not save up worldly wealth and possessions." Or, again, he says, "you should not judge others no matter how seemingly bad their faults." Or, he says, "you should never do righteous acts in such a way that will earn you praise." It hardly makes for bestseller self-help reading. And another issue about the nature of these teachings looms perhaps even larger. Jesus says that his teachings are a wise and firm foundation on which to live one's life. But he also implies that they will in no way make your life easier or more immune to tragedy. Winds blow, streams rise, and winds beat against all houses, no matter what foundation they're built on. In what way, then, Can we think of these teachings as being truly wise? Isn't wisdom supposed to make our lives easier, more secure, more prosperous, more happy? And the short answer, I think, is no. Because as we consider how Jesus' teachings are wise, we have to keep in mind the question of identity we discussed a minute ago. Christ is Emmanuel, God with us. And the wisdom of God is something far different than the wisdom of humankind. In another letter he wrote to an early Christian church, this one in Corinth, the same Paul wrote this about the wisdom of God. This comes from the letter of 1 Corinthians. He says, "For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, 'I will destroy the wisdom of the wise. The intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate.' Where is the wise person? Where is the teacher of the law? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe." The wisdom of God, Paul says, is foolishness to the world. Because the wisdom of God is demonstrated most fully in the message of the cross, that God would send his only son to die for the unrighteous and sinful. And so we need to be cautious to assume that what we consider to be wise is the same as what God considers to be wise. Temporal security, prosperity, and untainted happiness are mere illusions of a truly wise and good life. Because the wisdom of God, that world-flipping, self-denying, cross-accepting wisdom, has to be given priority at all cost. So Christ's teachings in the Sermon on the Mount, no matter how difficult, are truly wise. They're the highest form of wisdom we could possibly imagine. But that doesn't mean that they're easy or will always make sense. Rather, they are wise because they are teachings that will conform us most fully to the character of a loving God who chose to die for you and for me. Sometimes spoiling the end of a movie or a book or a joke ruins everything that's come before it. The anticipation is gone, the excitement is dissipated, and getting to the ending seems like a meaningless chore. But oftentimes, knowing how something ends can actually make you want to pay closer attention to what's come before. Knowing the ways everything fits together in the final equation causes you to attend more closely to the details of the moment. As somebody married to a diehard Harry Potter fan, I can tell you that my wife enjoys rereading the Harry Potter novels for the 8th, 9th, or 10th time, not because she doesn't know how they're gonna turn out, okay? But she enjoys reading them because she does know how they're gonna turn out. Because when she keeps the ending in mind, new details and meanings from early in the story emerge when she keeps that ending in mind. So my hope, therefore, is that by spoiling the ending of the Sermon on the Mount for you, you'll pay even closer to Christ's teachings in the weeks to come and see their importance all the more clearly. Because it's my conviction that the passage we just read in Matthew 7 acts a lot like a key to everything that comes before it in the Sermon on the Mount. And unless we truly wrestle with what it says about Christ's authority and wisdom, then we'll be liable to distort, misunderstand, and even reject the rest of his teachings in the sermon. And so if there's one thing I would hope that you would take away from today's sermon, it's this. That as you read the Sermon on the Mount in the coming weeks as a church, You'll do so always with the end in mind. That you'll understand Jesus' teachings, not as mere suggestions or helpful hints, but as things that are meant to be both heard and practiced. That you will be convicted of the need to embrace and practice Christ's teaching because you understand them as coming directly from the authority of the Almighty God. And that when Christ's teachings seem to be the opposite of the wisdom you would expect, you will remember that the wisdom of God is not like the wisdom of humanity. So whatever you do, please don't let the ending of this remarkable Sermon on the Mount fade from your minds. Endings, you see, are very, very important.